for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Attorney General Eric Holder defended the Justice Department seizure of Associated Press phone records. But journalists and First Amendment groups remain outraged. They deemed it an unprecedented use of the Justice Department's investigative power. Joining me in the studio to talk about the Justice Department's actions and whether they were justified to protect national security, attorney and former federal prosecutor Scott Fredrickson and Gabe Rotman of the ACLU. Joining us from a studio in New York City, David Folkenflik of NPR. You're invited, as always, to be part of the conversation. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
And David Folkenflik, before we get into the Justice Department story, fill us in briefly on the latest on the IRS controversy.
Well, obviously, the IRS has been a source of much concern. Not just Republicans, but many people have been very upset with recent disclosures that folks in a specialized office in the Cincinnati branch of the IRS had been looking over not-for-profits that had set up under a provision of the IRS code that allowed it to engage in certain kinds of social activity to determine whether or not it was actually more of a political organization. They were taking advantage of this code, many of them, to try to avoid having to disclose who their donors were. But the disclosures showed that, of course, as we now know, it appears that some personnel were looking specifically for Tea Party or other certain kinds of perhaps Republican-leaning groups. It very much smacked of a notion that a Democratic administration, somehow a branch of it, was seeking to get involved in a partisan way in assessing what should be a very nonpartisan exercise. Obviously, the acting IRS commissioner has stepped down under pressure from Treasury Secretary Liu. There's going to be a whole welter of hearings on the Hill. Their House Republicans are demanding to speak to at least five personnel about whether or not they were lied to and misled when questions arose earlier about this, particularly during the 2012 election season.
But apparently, Republicans are not satisfied yet. They feel as though at least one of them said someone ought to go to jail.
Well, you know, I think House Speaker John Boehner very much said in the last 24 hours, he spoke to the notion that, you know, it's not a question of who's going to resign. And I'm slightly paraphrasing, but it's close to it. It's a question, he said, of who's going to go to jail. And certainly you saw the president in that very brief terse. It wasn't really a news conference. It was a statement to the nation, although he'll take questions later on today. You know, he made clear that he wanted to be seen addressing this by the public on television and in person. But these questions aren't going to go away simply by virtue of an acting IRS commissioner being dispatched.
And now explain what led up to the seizure of the AP's phone records.
Well, it's kind of amazing. It actually stretches back to a story almost exactly a year ago in the first week of May of last year. The AP reported on something that, you know, you would think is a plus for the administration. You would think is a good news for the nation. An outfit in Yemen, sort of loosely affiliated with al-Qaeda, had been plotting to try to blow up a U.S. Airliner with an upgraded and a much more refined version of the underwear bomb that was unsuccessful several years ago. And the U.S. foiled this plot. And the Associated Press originally held off for a few days while they consulted with administration officials. And when they were told, according to the AP, that there was no imminent national security threat, they decided to publish it. The White House, or excuse me, folks in the intelligence and folks in the administration had asked the AP to hold off for an extra day to allow the administration to announce it. They reported it, and it now appears almost a year later, on May 10th of this year, they received at the Associated Press a letter from the Justice Department, short and sweet, saying essentially, by the way, just so you know, we've asked for all kinds of phone records to figure out how you got the information of how this was thwarted.
And to you, Gabe Rotman, you believe the Justice Department overreached.
Absolutely. And it's important to realize here that the First Amendment and the freedom of the press that it protects is not protecting the press. It's protecting the public. It's protecting our ability and our right to know what the government is doing in our name. And that's all the more important when it comes to national security cases like this, where the government has vast authority to make secret its activities. And this particular subpoena is so chilling because of two reasons. First, it's extremely broad. It covered 20 phone lines in offices where more than 100 reporters work. And then in addition to that, and perhaps more troubling, the Department of Justice elected to delay notifying the Associated Press that it had issued the subpoena for these telephone records. What that means is the Associated Press was robbed of the ability to go to court to challenge the subpoena.
So, to you, Scott Fredrickson, has the Justice Department specified why it actually targeted the AP's records?
Well, we don't know yet. There's a lot we don't know yet about this. We do, I think, understand this relates to accusations that there were deliberate leaks for political gain by the administration. And having to do with the foiling of the plot in Yemen to bomb an airline. The administration appointed went out of its way to appoint the U.S. attorney here in Washington to conduct its investigation. Obviously, it's always a concern when the press information is sought from the press. It's a difficult balance. Here we have the balance between, on one hand, the Attorney General, the CAI Director, the National Security Advisor, the FBI Director, all are adamant in telling us that these were the most serious leaks that put our country and Americans at risk, and also our allies apparently were furious. We don't know. There's a lot to be determined yet, but that's what led to this now.
So Attorney General Eric Holder was questioned about this Associated Press case. He said he has recused himself, and that's because he was questioned by the FBI on this. It becomes a very convoluted sort of situation, Gabe.
Absolutely. The recusal, I think, is understandable. The plot and the CIA operation would have been highly compartmentalized. So there would have been a small group of people who knew about it, one of whom would have been the Attorney General. So the recusal makes sense. What's interesting about the recusal is that that it wasn't in writing, it was apparently an oral recusal. And if I were the Deputy Attorney General and I were to launch an investigation of this scope, I would want something more than, you know, just a wink.
Dave Folkenflik, Eric Holder said he himself had not actually been the one to order that these phone records be investigated. Who did it?
It was the Deputy Attorney General Cole who did that in his stead. It's pretty interesting. You know, there are two quick things to say, one on each side. You know, for the Justice Department, you know, they're saying the reason this is – they don't want to say this on the record. But the reason, by all accounts, this is such an important thing is that it exposed a plan that involved a double agent. One of the key players in this bombing plot was a double agent for the West, reporting to Western, including American intelligence officials. And as a result, they were intending to put him back into Yemen and to keep him exposing folks there. And so they said, look, by virtue of the AP exposing this, it prevents us from doing that. They have to rush him out. They have to rush his family out so they don't get killed. This is a very severe compromise. From the Associated Press point of view, you know, I talked to a lot of media lawyers, including folks from the AP, and they say, look, we are responsive to national security concerns, but they have to come to us and they have to tailor their requests. And the reason they're supposed to come to us is so we can give stuff voluntarily and to challenge things in court, as Gabe has said. And the second thing is that there were 20 phone lines that were targeted over a period of some weeks. It's a little clear whether it was a full 2-month period or not. But part of the amazing element of this is it's not just 20 phone lines. Some of those phone lines were the main switchboards for the Washington, D.C. Bureau, for the New York City Bureau, the Associated Press, even for the corporate switchboard in New York. If you think of how many thousands of phone calls course through those lines, they're picking up all kinds of information that have nothing to do with this concern. And the AP reasonably asks, how does this fit with the department's own guidelines? The Deputy Attorney General had said, look, we're conforming with our own principles. We've conducted many months of investigations on this, some of which were urged by Republicans at the time. We've interviewed many people. But in this case, it seems like an exceptionally broad net being cast in a way in which the AP couldn't even know to challenge it.
Gabe.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And what's strange about this is the guidelines that govern the issuance of these types of subpoenas only allow notice to be delayed when it would seriously impinge upon the investigation. But here the investigation was public. And in addition to that, there's no reason to suspect that any of this evidence would go away. It was in the hands of the telephone companies. So it's unusual, and I think we need to find out exactly why notice was delayed.
Gabe Rotman, he's legislative counsel, policy advisor for the Washington Legislative Office of the ACLU. Short break here. We'll be right back. And in this hour, we're talking about the Justice Department's disclosure that it seized phone records of the Associated Press without first informing the news agency, which is standard operating procedure. Now, news of this has really garnered attention from First Amendment groups like the ACLU, which feel that the Department of Justice has overstepped its bounds. Here is an email from Jonathan, who says, Eric Holder says AP's leak was one of the first worst he's seen, but it's unclear how and why it was so damaging. Similar to WikiLeaks, there's a lot of whining about how leaks threaten national security. But when we see what's actually classified, I'm not sure why most of it was secret. Scott Fredrickson.
So a few points to the email, and I think when we left our discussion. It appears that the story did compromise the ability of this agent to continue efforts both on behalf of the U.S. and the British and others to find this bomber and to prevent future airlines from being bombed. It did compromise that from everything we're told right now. Second, The AP and the reporters are not the targets here. It's the leakers who leaked this information.
The leakers
in the government.
In the government at some high level.
Some high level.
We don't know where.
Which is, and an investigation starts by identifying who has that information,
right,
and going to question them. The DOJ did over 550 interviews. And by the way, this is not a public investigation. This is a criminal grand jury investigation, and that's why DOJ can't tell us more about that. Next, DOJ conducts over 550 investigations, tens of thousands of documents. Then they get the phone numbers. Now they need to figure out who's calling the reporters. And so keep in mind, when DOJ subpoenas these records and gets these records, they don't get content. This is not a wiretap. They're not looking at emails. They're looking at phone numbers and trying to match that up with the individuals they've identified in the administration with this information. And that's all that's going on right here. So was it overbroad? We really won't know. But I can tell you that if you're going to prosecute these leakers who compromise our defense and the safety of our citizens, you've got to do a complete job and get all those records for the relevant time period. Or when you prosecute them, the case will be criticized and be subject in a trial to the allegation that they didn't do a thorough job of investigation.
Gabe Brotman.
The facts need to come out. But what has been reported today is that the Associated Press, in terms of compromising the informant, the Associated Press didn't mention the informant in the initial story. What had happened was the Department of Homeland Security, prior to the story coming out, had put out a release saying there were no threats on the anniversary of the Osama bin Laden operation. After this story came out, it was clearly inconsistent with that announcement. John Brennan, who at the time was the counterterrorism czar, was on a phone call with his predecessors in that position, and he said that the reason why there were no threats is because we had insider control of this threat. And that's what led, or at least the news reports that are coming out today, that's what led to the outing of this informant. And then the second point is just in terms of the scope of this and the information that you receive. The outgoing phone numbers from 20 phone lines, including the Congressional Press Gallery, disclose an enormous amount of information, an enormous amount of information that has nothing to do with this investigation. You can take a very clear and detailed picture of the AP's news gathering activities, but simply by getting those outgoing phone records.
Here's another email from Marion McLean in Louisville, Kentucky. This for you, David Folkenflik. She says, journalists seem to think they can act with impunity. They put people's lives at risk and expect not to have to answer for that. Also, think about the Valerie Plame leak that put operations and people at risk as well. Journalists also have to be more responsible. How do you respond, David?
Well, and I remember you and I talked a fair amount during those Valerie Plame
days.
There were a lot of lessons out of what's called the Valerie Plame leak case. But, you know, we think of, Judy Miller, the former New York Times reporter, being in a sense in the dock, being challenged not as a target, but because she had information that the prosecutors wanted. One of the things we learned is that the machinery of federal government in the form of the Justice Department tends to get what it wants from the press if it really pushes. But it was frustrated in another case involving Judith Miller, then at the Times, and of Philip Shannon, involving an outfit in Chicago. They wanted information and sources. And the Justice Department, essentially did what it's supposed to do by the guidelines. It told the New York Times that it wanted that information. And that gave the Times a chance to hustle into court and to challenge that. And it tied up the Justice Department for months, I believe over a year, in terms of getting access to the information it wanted. There's belief among media lawyers that the Justice Department took that as a lesson and said, in certain kinds of cases, we're just not going to ask for permission or give notification, give people the chance. There's a very nebulous provision that allows the Justice Department to decide that it doesn't have the ability to wait and to just go and get it rather than informing and giving people a chance to negotiate or to challenge. But, you know, the real role of the press is to challenge authority, is to challenge government, is on behalf of their audiences to ask the government what it's doing in their name. And if you're unable to do that and to be checked, if you're unable to challenge the decisions of the government to essentially intrude or invade upon the journalistic process, you know, who gets to watch the government? What form does a watchdog take?
On the other hand, if by bringing in lawyers you delay the process, doesn't that also affect national security, Scott?
Well, I think you're right, Diane. I think David's right. I think DOJ absolutely learned from the prior lesson. And I think the reason they didn't tell the AP ahead of time is they realized they wouldn't get these records. I'm guessing a year would be optimistic. The AP, rightly so, would fight this as it in their job is to protect the freedom of the press, and they do a great job of it. But they would have tied this up. I would say this would go to the Supreme Court. I think it'd be 2 years. By that time, all the potential leakers would have certainly known what's going on. It would have, in the DOJ's view, compromised the integrity of the investigation. Look, I defend individuals all the time and companies. The fact is the federal government has a grand jury and the prosecutors can use subpoenas and search warrants, and there's very little we can do except after the fact to challenge those things. It's just it is a fact of life. But here, that is why DOJ did not tell AP ahead of time.
Jay Brotman.
Well, this was a public investigation. And it was a public investigation of an alleged wrong that had already happened. So justice isn't supposed to be efficient. Justice is supposed to be deliberative and just. And in order for that to happen, sometimes it takes time. Here, if in fact the Department of Justice short-circuited the its own guidelines, which were put in place to protect the freedom of the press, simply for expediency's sake, that's of great concern.
Well, they didn't short-circuit. They didn't go around. There's a specific provision in 20 CFR 5010 that says that they must notify the media in advance of getting the records, unless doing so would pose a substantial threat to the integrity of the investigation. You and I don't know exactly why they did that, but clearly they did that pursuant to that. If they did that for the wrong reasons, then I suspect and I hope there will be a lot to pay. But for now, we know that's why they did that.
Is the New York Times also under investigation?
It is. And this is the other fascinating thing, because this is David Sanger of the New York Times wrote this great article, great book about Stuxnet, the American-Israeli attempt to sabotage the Iranian, you know, nuclear facilities with a computer virus. Well, at the same time that the president appointed Ron Machen, the U.S. attorney here in the district, to investigate this matter, he appointed Ron's counterpart in Maryland to investigate that leak about the Stuxnet virus. So that's still to come.
Okay. And Gabe, before we open the phones, talk about the Shield Law.
And that's absolutely this case is the prime example of why we need a reporter shield law, a federal reporter shield law. Already 40 states have some form of shield law that protects reporters from having to disclose their sources. The president, to his credit, asked Congress to introduce and pass a shield law yesterday. Unfortunately, the version that's going through right now, I don't think would have done anything to prevent what happened here with the Associated Press. And in many ways, actually could make the problem worse. So Congress...
How so?
So, for instance, it actually would provide for the same delay of notice, but actually would allow for indefinite notice under the version that was marked out of committee back in 2009, which my understanding is what's on the table now. So Congress needs to get legislation, comprehensive shield legislation, that would prevent what happened here from happening again.
All right. I'm going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Port Orange, Florida. Good morning, Lance. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. You know, first let me say I'm a huge fan of your show. I love how you challenge different things and how you bring them to light with the public. So thank you very much for that. So I have a couple of comments that I'd like to say, and then I'll take, the answers off the air. The first thing is I have no doubt that, what everybody here wants is, public security, is national security. And, it seems to me that there is a fine line of me knowing everything that everybody's doing in every situation and the ability that these agencies have to actually provide the level of security that we need to protect this country in the way we need to, especially in these times. So, I kind of feel like, everybody wants to be involved and be part of the, scrutinizing, of different actions that people are taking. I'm wondering on one aspect, how much of that is politically agenda driven, and how much of that is truly looking to, make sure that the process is serving the ultimate goal.
Thanks, Lance. Scott.
Lance, you're absolutely right. It's always been a tremendously difficult job to advance freedom of the press and national security here, and it always will be. It's the nature of our system. Freedom of press has a cherished place. We have the most freedom of press of any place on this planet right now. But we've never had such a challenge to our national security as we have now, and that's why you see even more of the conflict between the two going on right now.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. David Folkenflik, how much of what you have seen and reported on seems to be politically motivated?
In this instance?
In this instance.
I think there's some deeply held beliefs on both sides. From the reporting that I've done, from the reporting our colleague Dina Temple-Raston has done, part of the deal was not just to make sure that double agent wasn't killed. The feds were very concerned because they didn't plan to reinsert him to get this, epically famous or infamous bomb maker, Ibrahim Ahiri. And there was, this was essentially a fairly significant effort of theirs that was disrupted. That said, political pressures come to bear. Republicans have argued for a long time that leaks that the administration want out there are not investigated, and leaks that the administration doesn't want out there are, and that there seems to be some sort of funny calibration. I think it's exactly right that, national security and First Amendment or press mandates are somehow have to be balanced. But in reality, there's a tension. There's an enduring tension between the two of them. And that's not easily resolvable. When you add a political element or when you add the sort of motivation of often people trying to spare themselves from embarrassment, people trying to send a message to others in the administration that leaking is not a form of checks and balances they'll support, particularly in the post-9/11 world, I think you're sending some very strong messages about the flow of information at a time when government is trying to often constrict that, despite, and I think this has to be stressed, an administration led by a former constitutional law professor, a liberal, who, while campaigning for office, stressed the need for transparency. And so I think there are a lot of sort of threads pulling in different directions that we're seeing play out here.
At the same time, he has been aggressive in going after leaks.
Well, he has.
Exceptionally.
He has. David's right. And he's done his administration has instituted more prosecutions and investigations than I think all the presidents combined before him. And so there's a terrific irony that someone like President Obama, a liberal, a constitutional law professor, would have this record. But there's a good reason for it, I think. For instance, this situation, the administration was being accused of deliberately leaking this for political gain to make them look tougher on terrorism and such. And so I think he did the right thing. He not only started the investigation, he appointed a U.S. attorney to make it even more independent. Now, it's come back and hurt him politically, but the fact is the president has nothing to do with this investigation. The White House can't influence criminal investigation. That'd be a criminal violation.
Gabe.
So 2 points. The first one is that I agree completely that selective leaking, leaking for political gain, is the worst of all possible worlds.
And that's what the president has been trying to shut down.
That is, it looks like, why this is such an aggressive investigation. However, perhaps the worst of all worlds is when you don't actually engage in a targeted and narrowly focused investigation to get at the actual high-level leaker. You go after the press because it's easy. And that's the fundamental problem here, because you know that the press has actually disclosed this information. So you know exactly the records to go to. But you need to engage in this dragnet approach in order to sweep them all in. That's the problem. It's not narrowly focused.
Kay Brotman at the ACLU. David Folkenflik, he's on the line with us from New York. He's media correspondent for NPR. Scott Fredrickson, former federal prosecutor and independent counsel. We'll take a short break. When we come back, your calls, your comments.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by IFC, with its newest scripted comedy, Marin, starring comedian Marc Maron, starts Friday, May 3rd at 10 p.m. Eastern on IFC. This is NPR.
Robotic knees and ankles allow amputees to run marathons, climb mountains, and even skydive. How scientific advances in artificial limbs are changing lives. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Before we go back to the phones, Scott, I want to ask you, has the leaker been found?
Well, Diane, not yet to our knowledge, but I think they're probably getting close. So let's talk about how they do this investigation. They determine what's the universe of individuals who had this knowledge. They gather those documents, their records, their emails. They go interview them. And by the way, anyone who joins an administration has to sign an agreement that they agree to be interviewed and waive their right not to be interviewed before they in advance. And if they don't, they can be terminated. And so if you don't agree to be interviewed and you can get terminated, that tells them a lot. And then they ask the questions and they get your phone numbers. And if that person lies, that's a 5-year felony, and that's the false statement, and that's oftentimes the heart of the prosecutions you end up having there. Now they have the phone records. They'll match up the numbers of individuals with the numbers of the called in with the reporters, and they'll get very close now to the leaker.
And just before the break, Gabe Rotman, you said that if you can't find the leak, it's easy to go after the press. How easy is that?
it's easy in the sense of you know exactly the questions that you need to ask. Whether you should ask those questions, though, is a question of constitutional scope. The press needs the most expansive amount. The press needs a great amount of room to do its job, because without it, we wouldn't know what the government is doing, especially in these areas. So it's again in the when I say that it's easy because you know exactly where to go. But we were just talking earlier. It's hard politically, as this has shown.
Indeed.
And that's probably a good thing.
All right. Here's an email saying, please remember how aggressively Republicans were in blaming leaks on President Obama himself. A DOJ investigation could not find the leaker after hundreds of interviews, so they got more aggressive. If the DOJ did not find an answer, they'd be criticized for not doing enough to source the leak, Scott.
Well, that's right. You know, I can tell you as a former prosecutor, when you get on one of these cases, it's in many ways, as interesting as it is, it's a lose-lose situation. When you touch the third rail of the press and to subpoena logs, that everyone knows that is immensely unpopular and going to be attacked. If you don't do this right, you're going to be attacked for fumbling the investigation. So it's always a difficult thing to do, and it's harder work because what they had to do here is they have to prove, one of the things they have to prove under the regulations internally is that they've exhausted every possible means to get this information, and the last means and the only way to do it is by sending a subpoena. In a standard grand jury investigation, if this was a private company phone records, the prosecutor would send a subpoena out there right away, not a problem. So there are immense difficulties and hurdles and lots of career consequences for these kinds of consequences.
All right, let's take a call from Brunswick, Georgia. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, David. I had a miscellaneous question I've been thinking about for days now, and it's a kind of a side issue, and it's related to the Boston Marathon bombings, because I can recall at least five occasions in the course of the investigation on that bombing when it was early on where I read that this information came from reliable sources with inside information speaking on the basis of anonymity. And what immediately bothered me about that was the police sometimes release only partial information in order to help their investigation. And from what I understand, the Boston Police Department and the FBI worked incredibly well with great coordination. And I don't know if any of the information that was released created a problem for the Boston Police Department or the FBI in the course of that investigation, maybe something they didn't want to have released. But my question is, now that the dust has settled on the Boston Marathon bombing, does anyone do any kind of a follow-up or review of what happened? And, you know, is there the possibility that they may go after somebody who leaked information that actually impeded a police investigation?
David Folkenflik.
To my knowledge, they haven't launched that kind of formal federal inquiry in the kind that we're describing today. Certainly there was, one can think of a number of occasions where major news outlets and local outlets in Boston reported things that turned out just not to be true. They cited what they believed to be reliable or authoritative federal law enforcement and local law enforcement officials. As you say, they were working well together. It was also just an incredibly chaotic moment and scene, and it's very difficult, as we've learned time and again, in the first minutes and hours and even a couple of days after an event that is as traumatic and as disruptive and horrible as that was, for us to expect that all people are going to be able to convey perfectly accurate information. And then the onus is on the press to sift through that pretty darn carefully. I think a lot of times the press failed to do that.
Here's a tweet. Should there be any disciplinary actions at justice, or maybe a resignation? In my opinion, the tweet says, in my opinion, this is worse than the IRS scandal. Do you expect resignations, Gabe?
I think all of the facts have yet to come out. And so we should reserve judgment until the facts do come out. I will say that this is the most expansive subpoena that I'm aware of in history.
Scott.
Well, she's just flat wrong. There's nothing to indicate anyone did anything wrong, just the contrary. They went by the book, they went by the regulations, and that's what's going on. If after the fact it shows that that there was a fishing expedition, and I don't think there is. These prosecutors are professionals. They know when they touch this, it's a third rail. It's electrocution to a career. So, no, absolutely, there should be no resignation. The attorney general recused himself. He did that correctly. He transferred authority to the deputy. That's fine. The administration had nothing to do with this once it appointed a U.S. attorney, which is even beyond the call of duty here. So, as far as we know, everything has been done by the book here.
All right, to Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Rick.
I just want to make a comment that the insinuation that lines were tapped, somebody keeps on saying lines and lines, and it's insinuating that lines were tapped, when in fact, as a gentleman said, that it was the phone records that were subpoenaed. Also, the media shield law, I believe that law was filibustered by the Republicans, if I'm not correct. Is that correct?
So the shield law was ultimately blocked by Republicans. That's right. There was a comprehensive bill that had momentum in late 2009, and the administration initially supported it and then switched its position and requested a broad national security exception, as well as something that would require a judge to give deference to the government when it came seeking these records.
And a number of people are asking about WikiLeaks. Here's an email. Weren't Republicans pushing for less protection for journalists after the WikiLeaks case? Doesn't the WikiLeaks case demonstrate the complexity of media shield laws when paired with the current AP case? David.
I would say complexity is a kind word for it, particularly when tripled with the overlay of the exceptionally divisive partisan political world that we're in. You have Republicans who had initially been adamant for the need of clamping down asserting the notion that journalists should have no additional rights of any other American. And there is a constitutional case to be made for that. But also, now saying, why is it that the press's freedom is being impinged upon? And earlier, as we teased out the irony of a liberal constitutional law professor president urging transparency on the campaign trail and cracking down to an unprecedented level here. I think that you're seeing that this is not a purely ideological position. Yesterday, Media Matters, which is a very liberal media watchdog group, does a lot of intensive research, but they a sort of sister site of theirs created talking points to defend the Department of Justice and saying, we have to be very mindful of national security concerns, which actually we all do have to be mindful of. But it was interesting to see a group that during the Bush years was, adamant about the need for openness and transparency come up with talking points that were essentially of a partisan nature when the Democrats were the ones who were initiating these things.
What do you make of that, Gabe?
I'm not sure. I think that this case, there's a lot more to be said about this case, and we're going to find out
a lot more to come.
Yeah. And as the revelations come, we'll be able to form a more concrete and accurate view of the propriety or impropriety of what happened here. Again, though, the breadth of this subpoena and the fact that notice was delayed remain of great concern.
Well, I would just add that, unfortunately, the administration good or bad, I guess, according to your political beliefs, has hit the trifecta here. But, you know, as far as this thing goes, if this is a scandal, it's a small s scandal. I don't think it's a scandal at all, and I think we'll see it's not, especially when the prosecutions, which I think will be coming, start. And I think we all need to take a deep breath. You know, people are out there talking about a wiretapping or search warrant. None of that happened here. You've got people who were accusing the administration of deliberately leaking, and so now they're pretending to have the uppermost, the deepmost concern over the First Amendment. And I think there's a lot of tongue-in-cheek here going on. Washington has a scandal as a cottage industry, and I think we need to take that into account.
Diane, if I might.
Sure.
Sorry, go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, it seems to me that there are very valid reasons why people on each side are coming up with the positions that they are, as far as we currently know. But we don't know much because the administration, the Department of Justice, has kept things inside a black box. But from a journalistic standpoint, you know, you can't be blasé when such a broad request has come in. You know, let's say for argument's sake, there's the question of who leaked something from the Homeland Security or from a national intelligence source, and you want to identify who the call went through from. If you do such a broad search, you're also going to get the guy who said, well, and this is, I'm making this up, this scenario, but what if somebody came up and showed that the deputy director of the CIA had been spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on Renaissance antiques and taxpayer money? Perhaps that same source, or excuse me, perhaps the number for that other source of that other leak would also turn up in that endeavor. It's hard to imagine that, you know, law enforcement authorities would not somehow notice when other kinds of leaks turn up, other kinds of journalistic exchanges happen that might not imperil national security, but certainly might not be appropriate from an administration standpoint.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Scott, you wanted to add something.
I think David is absolutely right, and I had to chuckle because if I may offer a different example, David Petraeus. You know, the information that ended that poor gentleman's career came up in an inadvertent way as well. But, you know, of course, if this is overbroad, it's got to be dealt with. We don't know yet. It was just phone logs, and it wasn't for the full 2 months. So I think keep that in mind. We shouldn't forget this. Let's look at it as it develops.
Yay.
I just want to jump in and make clear that phone log. So there was a caller who mentioned that, you know, that there's an insinuation that this is wiretaps.
Yeah.
It's not. This is a grand jury subpoena that is issued at the behest of the government alone, seeking the outgoing calls from these 20 phone lines. Now, that's important because it means that every call, not just the calls that are relevant to this particular case, are captured. And then there's no restriction on what the government can do with those, with that information. It will go into a database, and if it reveals other information that's relevant to the government, they can use that information.
So, David Folk and Flick, will these new revelations about the AP cause you or perhaps any other journalist to change its own practices in any way?
Well, let me put it this way. I've talked in recent months, last year and a half really, with reporters in Washington in particular and other investigative reporters. And at a certain point, the conversations keep going back to the TV show The Wire, where they look with some admiration the way in which certain high-level drug dealers had arranged a system by which you use, you know, these burner phones, phones that you can buy at a 7-Eleven or the corner store, and then throw out. And they say, you know, there are some reporters who have gotten to the point where they take phones like that, they give them to sources, they take a phone for themselves, and after a certain amount of time, they throw the phones out. And those phones aren't registered as belonging to them per se. And the hope is you can elude detection. These are reporters who, by the way, don't see themselves doing anything illegal. They see themselves as trying to, you know, be a watchdog on government in all its forms, often involved in some pretty sensitive national security matters, while their institutions and the reporters themselves say they're very mindful of genuine and legitimate national security concerns. But to me, to look to a TV show about drug dealers as a way of thinking about how to circumvent subpoenas like this, say that reporters are taking this with a sense of humor, but nonetheless pretty seriously.
That's very interesting, Scott.
Well, it's fascinating. I mean, I've heard that too. And if I was counseling a media organization reporters, I would counsel them that they need to react to this.
React how?
Well, I'd say be careful. If you're talking to sources that can be compromised, I wouldn't be on a phone. I would not be on the phone, and I wouldn't be using any electronic means of communication. You know, the FBI and the department is going to propose updating some of our electronic privacy laws. One of the provisions is to require providers like a Google or a Yahoo or something to have a provision in there that if a subpoena comes in, they have the ability to record or tap that information. I mean, that is the reality now. Our freedom is as much challenged by the private sector as by the government.
Gabe, do you think anybody at the Department of Justice should be fired over this incident?
Again, we have to wait for all of the facts to come out before we before we address that question. But if I could, let me just pivot. And, you know, there's generally a sense that the disclosure of unauthorized disclosure of classified information is a bad thing. But it's important to note that without these types of leaks, we wouldn't know about Abu Ghraib and we wouldn't know about things like the CIA black sites. And that's a crucial point.
Gabe Brotman of the ACLU, Scott Fredrickson. He's with the law firm Foley and Lardner. He's a former federal prosecutor, independent counsel, and David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR. I thank you all. We'll keep an eye on this space.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rain.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and